Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Brian Fitzpatrick. I represent the appellant in this case, Jose Loera, Jr. This case arises out of two separate indictments filed against Mr. Loera. After the first indictment, Mr. Loera moved to suppress post-arrest statements he made to law enforcement officials.
Can you speak more slowly and distinctly? I'm having trouble understanding.
Sure, Your Honor. After the first indictment, Mr. Loera moved to suppress post-arrest statements he made to law enforcement officials after requesting counsel.
So, just to interrupt, the problem I have with that argument looked through the lens of ineffectiveness of counsel. I know you're making an issue preclusion, all the rest of it, but at the end of the day, reading the statements that he made does not leave me, anyway, overwhelmed with the thought that they were the turning point of this trial, or that they undermined the outcome of the trial, or whatever words you want to use. So even if he should have moved, and even if they had been suppressed, can you tell me why I should worry about this?
Sure, Your Honor. The standard for prejudice is a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different, and a reasonable probability is a probability sufficient to undermine the outcome.
That's exactly what I said, undermine your confidence in the outcome. So we all understand that that's the standard. But frankly, the exchange that comes in, even if it was a mistake, I'm having trouble getting that far.
Sure. And I think the exchange that came in was an offer to cooperate for Mr. Loera with government officials. The government had said that he repeatedly offered to cooperate, had offered to complete delivery of the vehicle to a man that was waiting for him with money. And that evidence is a consciousness of guilt, Your Honor. And so the government...
It's an indirect inference, right? You would agree with that. I mean, you've usefully set this out. This is the exchange on page 6 of your brief, right,
mm-hmm.
that we're talking about. And Mr. Loera says things like he wants to help himself out if he can. He doesn't want to stay in jail. He says he didn't know anything about the cocaine in the car. He knows he's supposed to deliver the car to somebody in Valparaiso and that person will have the money. That strikes me as all deeply ambiguous. Now, I don't disagree with you that maybe a jury might have thought, he probably was lying. He did know that the cocaine was there. But, you know, it's... Don't we need to weigh something like that against the rest of the evidence in the record?
Sure, Your Honor. And if I may, the government in this case had to prove that Mr. Loera knew that there was cocaine in the vehicle. And the only direct evidence of that in the record is the testimony by a government informant who had spent a significant amount of time on the government payroll, who had a long criminal history record himself, who had been deported and then held back in the country by the government. So that was the only direct evidence that Mr. Loera knew there was cocaine in the vehicle. And I would submit that the jury had every reason to doubt that testimony as substantially biased, that there was a motive that the confidential informant had to give that testimony.
But, of course, the statement he made to the police before he asked for a lawyer, pretty incriminating.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, the statement he made?
Before
the police, about Atlanta and his father and all that, it was all a jumble.
I agree. There was conflicting statements given to law enforcement officers as far as where they were going and where they were.
That was actually more harmful to him than what he said later about wanting to cooperate.
And I agree. You can infer certain things from that, but when the jury heard Mr. Loera was seeking to cut a deal with the government, I would submit that any doubts that they had about the confidential informant's testimony about his direct knowledge that he knew cocaine was in the vehicle, that those doubts were relieved when they heard Mr. Loera's offer to cut a deal with the government and to cooperate.
So maybe
I don't see this as a collateral. I don't understand this collateral estoppel business. This seems to me to be law of the case, right? You have an initial proceeding and dismissal without prejudice. You have a new proceeding. It's really one proceeding. And you have a judge changing his mind, her mind, whatever it was, his mind in the course of this extended proceeding. And so we have law of the case doctrine says, generally a ruling should persist throughout a proceeding and shouldn't be changed except by a higher court. But there are all sorts of exceptions, it's loose. And here, the initial proceeding, initial hearing on the exclusion of his, what he said to the officers after after asking for a lawyer. That was very cursory, and judge dealt with it very, very summarily, and then later the judge reexamines it, and you know, new considerations, and changes his mind. And if he didn't act unreasonably in changing his mind, then there's no objection, is there?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I would submit that these are two separate cases. The first case was actually dismissed.
I think that's really unrealistic, right? There was going to be it's dismissed without prejudice. That's not a final judgment, right?
Your Honor, if we look at it, for example, from the Sixth Amendment speedy trial lens, right? That because that first case was dismissed, that clock ran anew because a new indictment was then handed up. So I would submit that these are two separate cases, and that issue would apply.
Yeah, but that's sort of metaphysical. Or we'll call them two separate cases. But the second case is really a resumption of the first. And the first was aborted. Now it revives. It's reborn, right? So so the same issue arises again. And the judge, even if it was collateral, collateral estoppel is loose also. It's not a rigid rule. So I don't know why it would get hung up on whether the judge could change his mind.
Well, I would submit here that if collateral estoppel would apply here, which I believe it does because it's two separate cases, one of the issues here, and I think one of the issues you're getting at, is whether or not this was actually litigated and whether or not there was a final judgment in this case.
I'm not interested in those technicalities. The question is, was it unreasonable for the judge to reexamine this issue in the second trial?
I believe it was, Your Honor, and for this reason, especially in the criminal context, allowing the government to get a second chance at the motion to suppress grants the government a distinct advantage over criminal defendants.
Well, the government could have appealed the decision partially to suppress when it was first made, right?
Sure, they could have.
And yes. They didn't bother. They didn't care that much about it. But they certainly have a right to an interlocutory appeal on any decision to suppress, even though a district court could reconsider that decision later on.
They do have that right, and they didn't do that in this case, Your Honor.
We don't want to invite those interlocutory appeals.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
We don't want to invite those interlocutory appeals. And, of course, if you're worried about delay, you don't want to have a lot of interlocutory appeals.
That is true in this case, but I think there is an over...
You lose a year with an interlocutory appeal, right?
Potentially, Your Honor. I'm not sure how long exactly they would take. They may vary in different cases. But I think there is an overarching policy reason here in the criminal context. If I may give a quick example.
The defendants have a lot of advantage in a criminal case. The prosecution has a lot of advantages. And this isn't going to change anything.
Well, Your Honor, I think the government could at the end of a case, decide to just dismiss it because they realized they were wrong the first time around and when they didn't contest the issue in the first motion to suppress. And they can just go ahead and dismiss those charges and bring new charges and then get a second bite at the apple, whereas a criminal defendant does not have that luxury. A criminal defendant is fighting every step of the way for their liberty. They don't have the luxury.
Of course. You have all sorts of post-conviction opportunities, right?
Sure, and there are various standards that apply to those post-conviction opportunities, but essentially it grants the government a clean slate on an issue that was already litigated by the defendant in this case, whereas the defendant does not have that same escape hatch in their back pocket, and there's no chance, there's no foreseeable chance that they're going to get another opportunity to argue the issue again. And if I may, I realize I'm already almost out of time. Members,
okay.
Is there some time for rebuttal?
Okay, thank you, Mr. O'Malley. Mr. Fitzpatrick. Ms. Grameans?
Good morning. May it please the Court. Emily Grameans on behalf of the United States. The government believes that as to Loera's arguments with issue preclusion, that this Court actually should look at it, as the Court has recognized during my opponent's argument, that this is a law of the case issue. This court has recognized a general rule that a district court may go back and reconsider its orders or decisions on motions to suppress. And that is essentially what happened in this case. And the fact that the first indictment was later dismissed on Speedy Trial Act grounds does not in any way alter that general rule that, you know, law of the case and the judge can reconsider its decision.
But why not? I mean, it was dismissed without prejudice. If the government had done nothing and the statute of limitations had elapsed, that would have been it. So a dismissal is not a meaningless act. It's different from going back to get a superseding indictment. The government had blown it, actually, in ways that I found fairly shocking in the first case about what appears really to have been going on in this case in the U.S. Attorney's Office.
In this case, Your Honor, the dismissal on STA grounds doesn't go to or doesn't affect kind of that general rule because it is not the type of final judgment that is usually implicated in issue preclusion cases.
Well, but issue preclusion, remember, is a standard that doesn't actually necessarily need a final judgment the way we would in the civil side need for appellate review, at least to the extent the federal courts are following principles reflected in the Restatement Second of Judgments. It's just got to be a definitive ruling on the case. It was my point in raising the government's right to appeal is that it was definitive enough that you could have taken an appeal. I'm not inviting thousands of appeals on virtually anything, but the fact is it was the judge's ruling, and the government uttered not a peep, you know, when the judge ruled, and the government allowed it to stay. And it seems to me that's the ruling. And I don't see why the fact that once later on you get in trouble on speedy trial grounds, that somehow resuscitates this suppression issue, which is completely unrelated as far as I can tell.
My response to that, Your Honor, is the Supreme Court said in Bobby versus Byes, I believe, that relitigation of a given determination isn't precluded if the first judgment did not depend on that particular determination. And in this case, the judge's determination to dismiss the case was based on Speedy Trial Act grounds. And the earlier factual determination with respect to the suppression motion had nothing to do with the argument under the Speedy Trial Act. And so the government's position is that because the suppression motion was not essential to the judgment on the Speedy Trial Act grounds, while there was an order on the motion to suppress, the general rule that a district court could go back and reconsider that still applies because that piece of the district court's prior rulings was not essential to what amounts to the final judgment or decision in the first indictment, which was to dismiss it on Speedy Trial Act grounds.
So what if the government had dismissed without prejudice because of the suppression? There are some cases, this may not be one, but just hypothetically a case where the government chooses to do that, doesn't bother to take an appeal. Do you think in the next round, if they get another indictment, they can just, you know, redo whatever got done? Now you have something under the body against Byes standard that was an essential reason for the dismissal.
And that is what I believe is the distinguishing factor between this
case and
those.
So you concede that in my second case you'd be stuck with whatever you did the first time?
I believe so. I don't want to bind myself
I'm
with
not
going to
make
statement.
You bind General Holder, but the logic of your argument is going to be important however we resolve this case.
Correct. And I believe that my opponent has cited district court cases and other cases where that was the factual basis of the case, that the order on the motion to suppress is what led to the eventual dismissal. And perhaps in those cases, issue preclusion does apply.
Okay, so I actually, because time is short, want to turn you to the constitutional speedy trial consideration, because the lawyer raises only the statutory argument, and the judge finds that the government's interest in pursuing a different investigation is not a valid reason. You prevail first time in this court. on the with prejudice, without prejudice. Now, if it had been a constitutional argument, it would not have been optional to make it without prejudice. A constitutional speedy trial violation is with prejudice. So that's why it's important to see whether the lawyer's performance was substandard. And there are all kinds of things going on in this case that are very strange. The role of former Assistant U.S. Attorney Clarence Butler, which the district court judge seems to be very upset with. He's negotiating secret plea agreements. All of a sudden, he's dismissed from the case. There's some bad act going on. And the fact that the lawyer is asleep at the switch, not just briefing the second half of the motion with the constitutional argument, it's 19 months. It's way beyond a year, so you get the presumptive delay. I would say the district court really washes over the government's fault on this part, weighs heavily against the government.
Your Honor, the government's belief is that the district court, you have to look at all of the factors together.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do, and I think the district court swept quite a few of them under the rug by saying, oh, well, you know, it was a little bit the government's fault, but not very much. I think it's way big time the government's fault.
I don't understand the constitutional test, the four factors. How can you balance them? If there's no prejudice, does it matter how long the delay is?
We believe that it is a very high standard to show prejudice. Based on any delay.
No, but if there's no, I'm just puzzled. That's listed as a factor. The implication is that even if there's no prejudice at all, the person could get, as Judge Wood said, it could get dismissal with prejudice. I'm just wondering about that. Whether that's the government's position or. The government has a position on what the constitutional standard is?
Well, the government's position would be that the prejudice to the defendant is the key piece, and that the length of the delay, which kind of triggers the entire Sixth Amendment analysis, highlights the importance of the prejudice to the defendant, because the district court should not consider the other three factors unless there is that presumption of prejudice, and that then the other three factors weigh in with that.
The problem with that is you could have a situation where the threat of trial hangs over this person for the rest of his life, even though he's clearly guilty, right? So we'll put aside the prejudice. He's clearly guilty. But couldn't there still be an objection to someone not having the opportunity to go to trial year after year because the government just decides to, you know, let him dangle on a string?
We've had cases like that in which we have seen the government letting somebody dangle, and the lack of resolution has been seen to be prejudicial.
Yeah. And I believe that is certainly possible, but in those situations, the defendant needs to make assertions or specific assertions about the stress and anxiety.
Precisely, and that's what the lawyer didn't do. Here, that's why we're talking about ineffectiveness of counsel. This is not a direct appeal on constitutional speedy trial. This is what would have happened if the lawyer had done the right thing back when the government was misbehaving and raised a constitutional speedy trial point.
And while the attorney did not do it under the first indictment, the defense attorney did raise the Sixth Amendment issue in relation to the second indictment. And at that point is when the district court went back and looked at, essentially evaluated all of the factors under the Sixth Amendment as it pertained to that first indictment. It specifically looked at the delay from the time that Mr. Loera was first indicted to the time that the first indictment was dismissed, and balanced all of those factors and found that the defendant was perhaps not equally responsible for the delays, but also had requested continuances and delays, and in fact had agreed to the 4-month continuance that was the basis for dismissing the case on Speedy Trial Act grounds in return for his release on pretrial bond.
Yeah,
and
that's a little creepy, too. I mean, that's a whole different ball of wax. Does this mean the government is letting dangerous people out onto the street and releasing people for grounds not authorized by the Bail Reform Act as a carrot for waiving speedy trial? I mean, you're letting dangerous people out there? What are you doing?
I believe that a mistake was made under the first indictment, you know, obviously the...
It's entirely inappropriate for the government to release somebody. There's a presumption in favor of release. That can be overcome on the basis of a number of grounds. Everybody knows that. But you're saying, oh, no, it's actually just one more bargaining tool in the government's box. You know, we'll let dangerous people out if we think it'll bail us out of a Speedy Trial Act problem.
I do not believe that that was the motivation in
but
this
case. But you just
case,
said
that
it was. You said that justified the delay, and I don't think it does.
Perhaps I misspoke. I do not mean to indicate that it justified delay, just that that was part of the facts that the district court considered under the Sixth Amendment analysis.
I can't accept that as a fact. I mean, you know, if the government decides to release somebody who's a flight risk or somebody who's going to be dangerous to the public or somebody who otherwise should not be released, I don't care what it does for the Speedy Trial. I don't see how that justifies anything that you do in terms of the Speedy Trial Act.
And certainly if the government released someone that was a flight risk and then that person did, in fact, flee, that would raise issues of further delay and who would be then kind of to blame for those delays.
Well, as a quid pro quo for the Speedy Trial Act, obviously mistakes are made. I don't blame the government when people skip on, but if it's a quid pro quo, it's a different thing.
Perhaps, but I am not certain that there are facts that this defendant was a flight risk. Certainly the quantity of cocaine that he was, you know, found in a vehicle with and alleged to be transporting was a significant amount of cocaine, but we don't have the evidence or the information that establishes that this person was, in fact, a danger.
But you're saying it's the carrot. That's what I find offensive, that it's the carrot for letting somebody out. You say, well, he acquiesced in the four-month or five-month, whatever it was, delay while the government wanted to go off and investigate other people because he got the benefit of being released from prison. And that's the exchange that I don't see reflected anywhere in the Bail Reform Act. I don't see that as a reason. The government can also release people to reward them for waiving Speedy Trial Act problems.
Certainly. That is not there. Correct. It is not in the Bail Reform Act. But it is just one particular aspect of the delays in this case. You know, looking back, the four-month delay, and certainly under the Speedy Trial Act, you know, that was improper, and the first indictment got dismissed for those reasons. However, that was not the only delay in this case, and the defendant did seek continuances apart from that delay that weigh heavily against the defendant.
So no matter how badly the government misbehaves, if you ask for so much as a single continuance, you've somehow waived your constitutional speedy trial argument?
I don't believe so, but I think you have to look at everything under a totality of the circumstances. And here, in addition to seeking continuances, the defendant also did not unambiguously and consistently assert his right to a speedy trial. It wasn't until, I believe it was November of 2006, that the defendant first asserted any type of a right to a speedy trial, and that is when the district court found that there was a Speedy Trial Act violation. And under the Sixth Amendment, all of those factors need to be looked at together. So while the one continuance of the that the government requested may have been improper, that is not the only consideration under the Sixth Amendment. And the district court did analyze all of those factors when the issue was raised under the second indictment. And there has been, Mr. Loera has not shown why those factors should necessarily be reweighed or that the district court's findings were, you know, such that this court on an appeal, had the Sixth Amendment claim not been found to be waived, would have disagreed with the district court.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Cremina.
Thank you.
And Mr. Fitzpatrick, anything further you want to say?
May Your Honor, just quickly on two points. The first point, as the government mentioned that Mr. Loera did not continuously and unambiguously assert his right, I would submit that the district court was wrong for weighing that factor, that third factor, against Mr. Loera. He did actually assert his right. Once he asserts that right, he does meet the baseline of the third factor, which then weighs in his favor.
Is there any, since this test for the speedy trial is so murky, Is there any case that is like this? Not in terms of the language of the case, but is any case factually similar? A 19-month delay, partly attributable to defendant's own request for continuance. No prejudice in the sense of, you know, makes it more difficult for him to get an acquittal, but there is the, you know, the oppression of living under the threat of a trial. But is there anything like this? My impression, we don't get many of these cases, is that it's only in quite extreme cases in which the government is held to have violated the Constitution.
Well, you're right. There aren't many cases out there, and there's not one that out with these specific facts in this case. But it is, as the government mentioned, a balancing of all the four factors. No factor is necessary.
What does that mean,
or
balancing of four non-quantifiable factors? What does that mean?
Well, Smith, that means that none of the factors are necessary or sufficient.
I know.
To make
where does that get you? Right.
That gets us to where, if in our case, we would submit that if three of the four, at least three of the four factors weigh in favor of Mr. Loera and against the government.
But you can't just count the factors, right? If you had a 20-year delay, you wouldn't say, well, yes, but on the other hand, the other factors weigh against that, right?
I agree. You can't necessarily.
Factors in a particular case, each of the factors has different magnitude of some sort, right? So that's why I'm curious whether there's a case like this factually.
Not one directly factually like this. And again, I think it's, you know, up to the court's determination to weigh all those factors together. But
Okay, well, thank you very much. So you were appointed, were you not?
Yes, our firm was appointed. Yes.
Okay. Well, we thank you very much for your efforts on behalf of the client.